The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Appreciate you hanging out with us. You know, that disclosure could only be a little longer. Make me happy, right? All right. Going to have a good show today. It's the investment show. We have a real treat today. Both Rod Holloway and Eric Giesler, both from our office, Comprehensive Financial, are in-house, not on the phone, but actually in the house. So looking forward to having a great discussion with them. Lots and lots to talk about. It's going to be very interesting, so you want to hang around for sure. Let's do a little news of the week first of you. First of all, brought to you by Indiana Dave Real Estate. Are you buying or selling? Dave wants to discuss your needs. Indiana Dave Real Estate, easy to Google and easy to Yelp. All right, June is ranked as the 11th out of the 12th month for average total returns in the S&P 500 since 1992. The only month was August that has a worse performance track record. All right, between now and the end of 2018, the Federal Reserve has 13 scheduled meetings. We'll talk about some of that in a few minutes. The median estimate of the Fed policymakers suggests that five separate rate hikes are in order of a quarter point each. So we'll see if that really happens before the end of 2018. The next Fed meeting, of course, is coming up June 13th. Too pessimistic? This was interesting. An annual survey of Americans at least age 65 gave the U.S. stock market at least a 50% chance of rising in the upcoming year, only one time over the past 12 years. Now, what's interesting is the U.S. stock market was actually up 10 of those 12 years. That's from 2002 through 2013. That comes from By the Numbers. And then finally, President Trump released last Tuesday a 10-year budget forecast that projects the U.S. of achieving a balanced budget. That's annual tax revenues that equal or greater than our outlays during the fiscal year 2027. So when the current fiscal year 2017 ends, the U.S. will have failed to record a balanced budget in 52 of the last 57 years. Now, this isn't the first time we heard this. President Bush, just a month into office, delivered his first address to Congress, and Bush encouraged members of Congress to join me to pay down $2 trillion in our national debt in the next 10 years. When Bush left office, we actually added almost $5 trillion to our debt. So we'll see, Donald, if it works out that way. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, Eric and Rod will be joining me. We're going to talk first about the Fed. The Fed announced recently all of those bonds they bought that are sitting there earning interest, they're going to have to be unwound, which basically means they're going to start selling some of this stuff. $4.5 trillion. We're going to Eric's reaction to what that could do in the bond market. And then also, if you remember, I was asking myself, why is it that the Fed or why is it that the government's only selling short-term bonds right now? Why wouldn't you finance really long-term bonds? I'm going to get Eric's thought on that as well. And he talked to me about it today, and it made a lot of sense and no sense all in the same vein. And then later on, Rod will be talking about the market. I mean, it's been on a tear, obviously. Summer lull, possibly. We'll talk about that and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. It is the investment show, and it's a real treat for me to have both Eric Giesler, our fixed income manager, and Rod Holloway, our equity portfolio guy. We were joking last week, Rod, that the equity guys are glass half full, the fixed income guys are glass half empty. Is there any disagreement with that?
No, not over here.
That's why I'm standing between the two of you today. So, going to keep you.
It's a great balance.
It's a good balance. Yes, it is. Eric, while we have you here, interest rates have to go up. I have this discussion nearly every single day with people, and they say, well, the Fed's going to raise rates, so rates are going to go up. And I'm like, not too fast. The 10-year Treasury's remained at a pretty tepid level for quite some time. the Fed will start raising rates again, likely in June. But to me, the biggest story is their balance sheet. They, all those bonds they bought after, 2010, they're sitting there earning interest, getting paid off, money being returned to the Treasury. I just look at that and think to myself, because they were the biggest buyer of bonds back then. I'm thinking to myself, now if they start selling these bonds, that's got to be pretty disruptive to the fixed income market or the economy or something.
Well, I think the important thing is how fast that they do it. Right now, they're talking about a very slow or gradual selling of the bonds. Mm-hmm. They're trying to minimize the impact.
What would happen, though, if they dumped, you know, $1 trillion of debt on the market?
Well, you'd see the price of those bonds go down, and you would see generally yields across the curve go up. And so they don't want that to happen as a result of what they're doing. They'd like to see it happen naturally.
Because that'd be temporary if that happened. It wouldn't be a long-term thing because the bond yields always represent projected growth and inflation. And obviously for the 30-year bond, saying to us, not a lot there.
Well, you would think it would be temporary, but if it takes a year or two to do it, that would be rather disruptive to the economy. Because as rates go up, obviously it has an impact on mortgage rates, on borrowing rates, on your credit card rates, all of those things. So it's important about how fast they unwind those positions.
And obviously there's not a lack of appetite for the U.S. Treasury bonds because every time that they put them out there, boy, they get ate up pretty quick.
Well, that's absolutely true because the United States continues to have some of the highest government yields in the world. The rest of the world's pretty much at zero. The United States is at least better than 1% across the curve. The bond market tells us right now that they don't think it's going to happen very fast. They don't think that those positions will be sold very quickly. So it'll be over time. And like I said, the Fed's going to do everything they can to not disrupt the market as it is today.
Rod, you and I have talked about this. So Eric and I have talked about this. But if you're a business guy and you could go out and refinance your debt at 3% for 30 years or, heck, 3.5% for 50 years or maybe even 4% for 100 years, you'd do that all day long. But for some reason, during the first part of this year, I happened to look at what the maturities were of the bonds being sold. They were all short-term debt. And I've been thinking to myself, what in the heck's going on? I mean, that's to a business person seems somewhat insane. Eric, you had a pretty easy explanation for me this morning.
Since the late 80s and in the early 1990s, the government figured out that if they could issue short-term debt, that was going to be at lower rates, and therefore the interest cost on an annual basis would be less. So as interest rates have continued to drift down, as they have for the past 20-plus years, the government has looked at that as decreasing the budget outlays on an annual basis,
sure,
rather than the long-term effects of having to pay a slightly higher interest rate but refinancing at one time.
Yeah, you get it. I get that. I mean, I'm basically, you know, borrowing short-term to pay less to make my budget look better at the sacrifice of maybe later on. So I don't know, Rod, it seems crazy.
Well, I think that in the corporate world, they typically refer to that as creative financing, you know, the stock buybacks and things like that make your overall fundamentals look a little bit better. But really all you did was retire some of the outstanding shares of stock. You know, I think we've talked about it in many times. Obviously, it makes sense when what you're borrowing to buy is a long-term thing.
Mm-hmm.
So from an infrastructure perspective, I think that's where we've all had the discussion that it would make some sense to issue some long bonds to pay for infrastructure because the infrastructure is something here for a long time. You know, you wouldn't issue a long bond to go out and upgrade a whole bunch of computers for the government. You know, that's a short-lived thing and something that you wouldn't want to be paying your interest expense on 30 or even go 50-year bond all the way out, and you've already turned over those computers 10, 15 different times while you're still paying on that debt. But for a brand new sewer, brand new tunnels, bridges, trains, airports, all of those types of things that are around for much longer than 50 years, potentially 75, 100 or greater, I think that's where it does make make some sense. And we're not obviously always going to be in the environment we have been in for a long period of time in which interest rates continue to go down. So the government has been on the right side of that trade by continuing to issue the shorter term as rates continue to go down. While people have been predicting for a long time rates are going to start going up and they haven't moved as quickly as other people have thought, they are eventually going to move. Now, when that is, I'm not about to make that prediction, but they will eventually start going up, and then that game changes if the government continues to think that that short-term gets refinanced into lower short-term.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue this talk on the Investment Show. It's the first show of the month, which has historically been that Investment Show. We're going to pin Eric to his chair and not let him leave, because I love to hear the counter arguments when it comes to, you know, strong corporate earnings, first quarter GDP. You know, obviously housing has softened a little bit, but I think that's temporary. But we're heading into summer. What to look for and more. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Well, that was good summer music right there. Maybe you want to sit next to the pool, maybe have a margarita, whatever, cook some chicken wings. All right, Memorial Day weekend's passed. I get it. All right, have Eric Geese, our fixed income manager, and Rod Holloway, our equity portfolio guy, in-house. And, Rod, we've been talking about how the market for years and years, I've heard you on Glass in the Morning, be very driven by the Fed-driven. Now it seems to be more fundamentally driven. And every time, you know, a report comes out, it seems this, you know, even if a negative report comes out, there's more positive to kind of underpin the rally that we've seen in the equity markets. And obviously with first quarter GDP revised upward, I think, 80% of S&P 500 companies or so beat their first quarter earnings estimates. I mean, and the forward-looking statements seem to be pretty good. Yeah, we had housing prices soften a little bit, or sales. Oil prices went down. You know, Fed, you know, unloosening their balance sheet here. But still, I mean, when you look at things, they seem to be okay.
Yeah, the economic numbers have been a little choppy, and they've been that way really through the whole recovery. The majority of them are positive. As we've always said, it's been slow growth. We don't have rapid growth in any of them. Every now and then you'll get two or three numbers that kind of tell a slightly different story. But overwhelmingly, the majority of them, when you start looking at all of them combined, is that we do continue to have growth, albeit slow growth. Of course, from the earnings side, and that's what you referred to as far as Glass and what we've talked about, that it was a Fed and interest rate-driven rally that we had had off of the financial crisis in March of 2009 when we hit the bottom on the S&P 500. And now we actually are starting to see some earnings growth. So first quarter S&P 500, after roughly 98% of those companies had reported first quarter earnings, you had both earnings per share beat as well as revenue beat. It was about a 14% growth over first quarter of last year in that comparison. We had been seeing that number shrink. We had five consecutive quarters in which the quarter-over-quarter comparison was declining. So we ended that in the third quarter of 2016. We continued that streak in the fourth quarter, and then we continue and actually started to accelerate a little bit as far as the earnings per share growth, and picked up about 14% so far in the first quarter. And right now the projection for the rest of the year is to continue seeing that type of growth, not at the 14% level, but up there somewhere close to the double digit, 10% or so, give or take, because of course right now it's a guesstimate, and it's going to be adjusted as we continue to see earnings in the second and the third quarter and get more of the forward-looking statements from the corporations.
Yeah, the market moves on speculation, then it will adjust on reality or be underpinned based on the reality. Eric, will you listen to all this? Again, not trying to pin you down as a glass half empty guy, but I know from talking with you, just, you know, whether it's going to lunch or stuff that you sent me, there's another side of the story. And I think for people to be overly optimistic and not at least have some caution in their investments, it doesn't make sense either.
Well, I think the biggest question you have is, what are the risks that you're taking? What are the risks of those corporations not being able to have double-digit revenue increases or double-digit earning increases? What are going to drive that, or what's going to drive that to happen? We've, as Rod's pointed out, a lot of the indicators have been mixed. You've got mixed results. Interesting discussions going on about what's going on in retail, what's going on in the auto industry, how are interest rates going to be affected. So I think it becomes a question of risk. How do you justify continuing to buy stocks when they're at record levels? Do you really think they're going to go, the records are going to be pushed up? Those are the questions. I think they're ones of risk. Right now, I think that the appetite for risk is very high, and will continue to be, unless we get something like the Fed making a wrong move, or you have some geopolitical risk going on. But I think right now that in order to generate returns, you've got to take more risk, because there isn't enough volatility in the market and there isn't a velocity of money that allows you to just kind of sit back and collect a 5% coupon or a 4% dividend. That money is just not out there. So In order to have a reasonable return, you have to be willing to accept more risk. And those risks are, where is that revenue growth going to come from? Where is that earnings growth going to come from?
So. Yeah. And the problem, folks, is most of the time you don't know how much risk you can take until you've taken too much. Then it's like, oh, my gosh, I took way too much risk. I didn't even know I was taking it. I always like the discussions. Eric used to manage money for insurance companies, so obviously that's a very conservative posture. I always like the discussion that you guys have when you talk about investing in a company, whether it be I want to own their stock, I want to own their preferred, I want to own their corporate debt, because you might like a company's ability to repay the debt, but maybe not so much on the growth in the stock market. So I enjoy those conversations that you guys have.
Well, we had that discussion today about a particular company that the debt looked very attractive. Did they have the revenues? Did they have the balance sheet to and the earnings to pay their interest payments? Mm-hmm. That's a lot different than saying that they have the revenues to grow their
stock price, grow their equity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we had that discussion today, and that's a balance of risk, right? How much risk are you willing to take? It's okay to take some risks and not okay to take others. And in other instances, where the growth potential for a company might not necessarily be indicative of them taking on more debt. So it works both ways.
Yeah,
but it's a matter of risk.
Yeah, I don't think Rod would buy an equity if he didn't think they could repay their debt, though. I think it's more of a one-way street this way. Well, maybe you would. I don't know.
Well, it depends what the trade is for. I mean, there are trades. There are times that you jump into a stock because right now it has momentum behind it, and it may be very short-lived momentum,
trade. Hasn't shown any earnings, or maybe they are. Yeah, right.
Sure, or the earnings are minimal, or it's a brand-new product, so you still don't know. You know, obviously, social media has kind of been that in a big way. It's a very hot thing socially as far as people, whether it's playing the games on the social media websites or just participating in all of the different social media platforms that are out there. But just because they're very hot and everybody is participating in it doesn't mean that the earnings and the revenue growth is there. So that's the thing that has always been in question with any of them. Can they monetize it? It's great that they have an unusually large amount of users and daily users, but are they monetizing those users in any way, shape, or form? So, yeah, from time to time that you may do a trade in that scenario you're alluding to, in which you wouldn't be willing to take a long-term bond position, but you may be willing to take a 6 or 9 month trading position,
or what is value? That's a big discussion that Rod and I have had lately as well. When you look at the energy sector, how much it costs to get oil out of the ground, and at what price does a barrel of oil make sense? Mm-hmm. Well, there are energy companies now that their stock prices we would somewhat consider dirt cheap. Are they at the bottom? We don't know. but they look like there is real potential for growth if they can continue to produce oil.
Yeah, but like Eric's saying, is that right now, the technically, they don't look like they found a bottom yet, but you're looking at it and going, you know what, we're getting very close to where they had got during the levels when oil was trading under 30. We're still coming out of a financial crisis. You know, there's a lot of fear with what's going on in the marketplace. Well, right now, yeah, oil didn't rally to 60 as quickly as everybody thought, but it's kind of held pretty sticky at that $50 range, so it doesn't appear as though there's a catastrophe going on in the energy world. But if you look at a lot of the stocks, it does appear so. You know, but I think along this line of conversation, the thing that I find interesting when I look, if you look at sectors for the first quarter, your top two performing sectors, technology, mm-hmm. no surprise there. Number two, utilities.
Yeah.
Now, that's a surprise because you know, technology is full-bore growth. I mean, that's not value. Yeah, there's some old tech. You could argue there's some value in it, and maybe a value investor would be looking at it. But overall, as a sector, that's a growth sector. And then you got utilities. It's a steady eddy. There isn't a lot of growth there. The cash flow's pretty predictable. People want to turn their lights on every day, so they pay that electric bill, and the utility company spits a lot of that back out in the form of a dividend. So it's kind of interesting when you look at it in your top two sectors. One is a go growth sector, and the other one's just a steady eddy, keep generating cash flow, but not a lot of growth involved in it.
It's funny because our office is a little bit like the utility company. Our phones have been pretty quiet over the last few months, unless people are calling in for new appointments. And I always say that our office is like the utility companies. They only call us when the lights don't turn on. So right now, things are fairly quiet at the office. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, hang on to these guys for one more segment, because if you are taking a cautiously optimistic approach to investing, what are some of the basic risk management strategies that are out there? Some are very easy to implement. Some are more difficult. We'll talk about those and more. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everybody. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Let's reclaim the clutter areas of your home with help from Bloomington Affordable Self Storage. It's over on 17th Street, newly remodeled, 24-hour on-site management. Call about their special at 812-339-4221. Eric Giesler, our fixed income specialist, and Eric and Rod Holloway, our equity guy, who you hear on Glass in the Morning, both on Mondays and Fridays at 7:20. To spread the cheer when it comes to the market updates, are here with me. And, you know, you guys heard these guys in the last segment, and that's why my job's really easy. My job is to, I was telling someone the other day, and Rod was in the meeting with me, that I'm kind of like the architect. I sort of build the plan, design the asset allocation, whatever it is, the taxes, the estate planning, whatever it is that we're trying to do. And then I just hand it over to you guys, and I don't have to worry about it. So, which is a really big luxury, because most of the time when you're in a field like ours, you have to farm that stuff out to a third party, whether it be a fund or a third party money manager, and you don't know what they're thinking, you don't know what they're doing, you only know from the rearview mirror what's happened. So you guys listening can see why I feel so fortunate. And we've been together a long time. Eric and I had lunch the other day, and we're reminiscing about our many, many years together, and Rod and I have been together over 20 years, so long relationships, and when that happens, you really gain a lot of confidence and trust for sure. So the investment show is here. It's the first week of the month, and Eric said it best earlier that, you know, are the markets at a top? Are we subjecting ourselves to a possible pullback? Maybe, maybe not. Who really knows? I always say the market's going to do one of three things, up, down, or sideways. It's only three things that it can do. But what I do want to talk about is what some basic risk management strategies are. And Ron, I'll start with you. The average guy out there in a 401k plan has funds to select. And there are ways that a person like that can manage their risk without just simply going all in and all out, which unfortunately a lot of people make that big mistake.
Yeah, sure. Especially in the 401k. Obviously, they have restricted tools available to them. They have what the 401k plan provides, which typically is going to be funds, maybe ETFs. You've seen a few more of those get in there. So some of the real hedging strategies that the institutional guys use wouldn't be available for the retail guy in his retirement plan. So what can he do? Well, he can do a few things. obviously one asset allocation. He can spread his assets out over both the fixed income and the equity side of thing. Even under those umbrellas, you can get even more diversified in fixed income. You can own short duration, you can own high yield, intermediate, floating rate. There's all kinds of different things there. Same thing on the equity side. Someone who really has concerns, they can either adjust that allocation. They can maybe build some cash, dollar cost average back in if they got really nervous, took some profits off the table and wanted to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to redeploy, but I'm not necessarily going to wait for a specific event to redeploy. I'm just going to start putting money in every month, so much out of that. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with ever taking a profit. Nobody did a bad thing by taking a profit, even if that underlying investment you sold continued to go up. You still have the profit even when it went up. You don't lose any of that profit because you didn't sell at the top, and the reality is you're probably not going to. So that's the basics for most retail people inside the 401k, is really that diversification, tilting one way or the other, or building cash to then dollar cost average back in and not try and time the market. Just say, hey, over the next 6 months, I'm going to put a little bit of this cash to work every single month until I'm 100% invested again.
And that's the basic, most common way to manage risk. But Eric, I know on the institutional side, there's a lot of products that have been developed, different hedging strategies, and it's difficult for an individual to do some of these when they have limited funds, limited knowledge. But
well, on the fixed income side, probably the biggest advantage that institutions have is the ability to short bonds in general, but primarily government or treasury bonds, which provides you a way to minimize the price change or the duration of a fixed income instrument. That's invaluable. Most large portfolios, specifically insurance companies or pension funds, they're more interested in the cash flow. They're not looking for the change in price to really benefit from that, as everybody in this room realizes that we can't control the future returns. Or we probably wouldn't be sitting in this room if we could do that. But also on from an equity perspective, institutions do a lot of options trading in order to hedge particular positions. They want to minimize the downside, or are willing to minimize the upside to minimize the downside. So there's a lot of option strategies because of their size and because of their sophistication that they can take advantage of those. That's a little more difficult for someone with an average retirement plan, whether it's in a 401 or an individual IRA account. Those are some of that is restricted by law, but that's difficult to do on a large scale. So there are alternative instruments out there to do that.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of those recently that are packaged products built by the institutions that will do things like give you so much of the S&P 500 over the next 5 years and protect, you know, like 10% of the downside. Or maybe they'll protect all the downside and limit your annual return to 5 or 6%. So there's just all kinds of structures out there. What are some of the risk associated with those? Because obviously you look at it and think, hey, I'm actually taking less risk, but like liquidity risk maybe? There's some other risk out there that you may not even have thought about.
Yeah, sure. I think that's perfect. And liquidity risk in many times is a big one, because you own a product that on the surface, obviously financial institutions aren't in the business of creating products that don't look appealing. I mean, who's going to buy it if it doesn't look like a good deal? So they're in the
You're saying they put lipstick on the pig sometimes,
they,
out, right?
They do sometimes put lipstick on the pig. So, you know, and that's where it's important to know and understand why you own it, why it fits into your portfolio and what you want it to do long term. And part of that risk and the liquidity risk is, because normally as you're talking about, when you're talking about these buffer notes, barrier notes, principal protected notes, those types of things, there are certain triggers that kick in and affect those. Well, if the trigger kicks into a certain point and now all of a sudden your yield or your potential return is far lower than what you can get in an open market without any of these hedges put on, well, you know what? Your product is no longer as valuable in the marketplace anymore.
Right.
So it can be sold, but it has to be sold at a deep, deep discount to get someone to buy. So that's potentially what you end up with. So if it's a fixed income instrument paying you a coupon per se, and it started out paying 4 and now it drops to 2 and the market's paying greater than 2, well, you know what? You may be stuck owning that product, collecting only 2 in a 3% marketplace because you're not willing to give up the loss to get out of that product to go buy the new one, because obviously the new person's going to say, hey, you know what, I can buy it for 3 all day long, so I'm not going to buy yours for 2 at par value. I'm going to have to take a deep discount to do that. And the retail person typically has been programmed to say, well, gosh, if I own this and the entity is still around at maturity, then I get my par value back. So it makes it really hard for that retail guy to swallow that loss to move on. They don't necessarily think in similar terms of the institutional guy. Eric and I have this conversation many a times, and we'll look at a bond and someone who's wanting to get more growth in their portfolio, and we'll say, oh, gosh, we're going to sell this, but we're going to take a bit of a hit on the discount because we're going to have to sell it at a discount to get out of this. When we start talking, well, you know what? You only need to make 1% per year in growth on the equities to make up for this over the next 2 years or 3 years. So normally when you actually start breaking it down, it can be fairly minimal what you have to do to accommodate that loss. But liquidity typically is a big one, because really what happens is it no longer is performing like the rest of the market is. Therefore, it's less appealing for a new buyer to come in and buy off of you in the secondary.
But I think you've hit a very hot topic, and that is nobody likes to hear the word loss.
Yes.
And that becomes the hurdle that Dave often has to have that conversation about. And it's, why did you take that loss? Why would you sell something that was down in price? Don't you think do you think there's something wrong with it? Well, not necessarily. It's just that the market doesn't perceive the risks or the market has changed so that it no longer has the value that you thought it had.
Yeah, the portfolio is the sum of its parts. If you start looking under the hood, there's a lot of things you're not going to like to see.
Exactly.
Eric Giesler, our fixed income specialist, and Rod Holloway, our equity portfolio manager, has been my guest. We're going to take another break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about unraveling the retirement tax bracket dilemma. This is good stuff. It kind of builds on last week's show as I built the case to put more money away tax-free today. Don't wait, but it may come to catch you later. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It's Your Money with David Hayes. It's been the investment show. If you missed any of it and you'd like to hear it again, Saturday mornings, 9 a.m. Always on WGCLradio.com. We'd love for you to become an iTunes subscriber. We're getting a lot of traction there as well. Just pop it up on your Bluetooth in your car and listen to it. It's 42 minutes long on average, 43. So take advantage of that. Google Play Music as well. Hey, if you want to support a really great cause, the Bloomington South Wrestling Club, they're actually trying to raise money to go and wrestle at Disney in just a few weeks. So they're still, you know, trying to raise money to keep these kids' costs down. It's a great experience. They're there for almost a whole week. They wrestle until they can't wrestle anymore. But go over to Texas Roadhouse, and it's donation night. 10% of everything that you spend will go to the South Wrestling Club. Dine-in or carry-out, so either option there. But make sure when you go, you simply say, hey, I'm here to support the South Wrestling Club, and they will, boom, give the boys a 10% and girl 10% discount or donation from your bill. So take advantage of that. Also, Class 101, don't miss the free ACT-SAT boot camp for parents and high school students at Class 101. It's on Saturday, July 8th. Register by calling 812-287-8472. That's 812-287-8472, or you can Google My Class 101, Bloomington, Indiana, and it will pop right up. Okay, we've been on this kick, right, for a while, trying to convince people to put more money away tax-free. I think that if you are putting money away tax-deferred, you're making a huge mistake. You're basically making a deal with the devil. You're saying, okay, I'll take that tax deduction now, and later on you'll tell me what I have to pay taxes or how much my taxes are going to be. That makes no sense whatsoever. Now, many cases, you can't avoid it. The money you put in may go into a Roth, 401k. The employer money goes into the traditional side, but you have to create some tax diversification. Now, let's say that you're already 60 years old, and you're saying to yourself, you know what, I've been plowing this money away tax-deferred all these years. I'm going to have to start paying taxes when I take it out. What can I do? Well, the idea obviously behind saving into tax-deferred accounts, it made sense because you thought, well, I'm going to be in a lower tax bracket during retirement. But unfortunately, because of the proliferation of 401k plans, I mean, that's where all the money is, just the amount of your minimum distributions at, say, at age 70 and a half might force you into a higher tax bracket during the retirement years. RMDs, they're a fact of life. Retirees have to deal with it. You either spend it or you save it. Now, a lot of times you receive the distribution, you pay the taxes, then you stick it into a CD or a savings account, earning very little interest. But what if there were a proactive approach to this problem? And this is what I want to start with. Let's start with the premise that there's not much that you can do or control over how your first dollar is taxed. But there are ways to reduce how that last dollar is taxed. If you're a married couple and you have taxable income, and that's after your deductions and your exemptions of $100,000, and you're filing a joint return, you're in the 25% tax bracket. Now, there's ways to reduce the tax liability if we would lengthen out the number of years that the distribution comes from your retirement account. So let's say you're 70 and a half and you wait until 70 and a half. There's a schedule that says here's how you take it. But one way we can do this, and this is why we do the show and talk about this so much, is to educate and advise everyone to start planning for the problems that we know they will face down the road. Think of it this way. Ask a 40-year-old if there's a decision they made when they were younger that they wish they could redo. I'm going to say 10 out of 10 people are going to say, I would change that. So let's use that logic and say, what would your 70 or 80-year-old self tell your 60-year-old self? Well, assume you have $1 million in a retirement account and you're 60 years old. Assume that your portfolio grows at about 6% per year. And when you turn 70 and a half, it's now worth over $1.8 million. So even after your $66,000 minimum distribution is taken out, the issue is that that you now face a higher tax bracket. So as an example, you were at $100,000, now you're at $165,000. So now you're at 28% on those next dollars. So the way our tax system works is it's taxed at the next dollar. Any of the income below $153,000 is still at 25%. Everything over that was taxed at 28%, then you go to 33%, then you go to 39.6%. So that additional 3% tax on the $12,000 may not sound like a lot, but just wait until you get to age 84. Now your minimum distribution is almost $140,000. Now that's enough to force a person into the 33% tax bracket. So taxes, as we know, are like life, right? They're a fact of life. It's in death. I mean, you can't avoid it, but you can manage it. You can manage this stuff. So if you take a proactive approach, and let's say that 60-year-old said, okay, I'm going to start right now taking $50,000 per year out of my IRA, and let's say convert it to a Roth, you could prevent a big tax bracket problem in retirement. Sure, it's a taxable event now. It's a Roth conversion. You got to pay the tax now. But let's look down the road. This person would implement that strategy at age 84, their minimum distribution, instead of $140,000, it's $73,000. That's huge. That saves you lots and lots of dollars. If you think about it this way, and this is why an advisor should get paid to help you with this stuff. If you're thinking about, okay, I'm taking, you know, what is that, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 less out as a required distribution at 33%, you can do the math on that. That's a lot of money. If we could save you that money, if we could save you that headache, isn't that worth it? That's what you should be paying for when it comes to a financial advisor. There's other things you can do. When you get to the age of 70 and a half, use the qualified charitable distribution idea. You can give money, I said it last week, directly to a charity from your IRA. It satisfies minimum distributions. It's not taxable to you. It's a fantastic idea. One thing I need to tell you, make sure your CPA, make sure your tax person knows you did it. We have been working with people amending their tax returns because when they brought them in for me to review, it's like, oh, hey, you counted all this as income. Oh, I forgot to tell them that was a charitable contribution. There's nowhere on the 1099 that says anything about it being a charitable contribution. So you have to make sure that you tell them. Put money in the Roth 401k. If you're a new person, just started working, put it in the Roth 401k. If you're a 60-year-old doctor making $350,000 a year, put it in the Roth 401k. You're going to need that tax diversification because just like we've said in shows prior, there is a big train coming down the track, and it's called taxes. And if you just pull down the window shade and ignore it, you're going to be run over. We're going to take a break, guys. When we come back, we're going to wrap up the show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Once again, WGCLradio.com. You can catch it then. Hey, next week we're going to be talking about this new Department of Labor rule. It's called the fiduciary rule. I haven't talked much about it because I wanted it to actually be in place. It's going in place, I think, next week. I'm going to talk about what it is, what it means to you, and how that relates to your relationship with your financial advisor. I'm going to have a guest on who's an expert in the area to talk about it, so look forward to that. Hey, I wanted to talk about this real quick. My father-in-law passed away on Monday. And a lot of you know that I've talked a lot about him and his disease with dementia, the progression of Alzheimer's, our ability to get him on VA benefits, our ability to keep him at home. We had Kathleen Weber on, who was a former head of the Alzheimer's unit at Bloomington Hospital that now is a personal counselor, who really helped our family just kind of get our hands around this thing. But we saw it to the end. We saw it to the end, and we're really proud of that. And we're glad that he was able to stay at home. He was able to have dignity, he had great care, and he died in his sleep. I'm not sure what more you can ask. So if you're a family that is struggling with what to do, because in our family, here's what happened. 3 or 4 years prior to us having to jump in, when you have that, oh, come to Jesus moment where you cannot not make a choice, how could we have managed that 3 or 4 years a little bit better? How could we have avoided him driving a state away and getting lost before we jumped in? And if you're at that point, I would absolutely love to help. I would love to help you. I'd love to help give you the resources to talk with you. Because some of the things that you, there's so many tricks. There's so many tricks that you can learn. And the things that you concoct in your mind that you think are going to be terrible, it's rarely as bad as you think. The issue typically isn't mom and dad's mental state and way they're going to perceive it to happen and go down. It's your fear of how this is going to happen. So you have to get over your fears before some of these changes can be made. I can tell you some tricks. I can tell you some stories. But the best thing is my wife and her brother and her sister were able to be kids. They were able to just love their dad and spend time with their dad, and it was great. They weren't changing diapers. They weren't, you know, doing all the things that he wouldn't have wanted, and certainly they wouldn't have wanted to do. It's an epidemic, the dementia and Alzheimer's. It's terrible, and you feel like you're alone when you're going through this. But you know, but you're not. I mean, there's so many people out there, so many great resources. At the end of the day, I mean, we just didn't want to deal with it. It was easier for us just to not deal with it than to deal with it. But then eventually you have to deal with it. So it's really better to kind of ease your way into dealing with stuff by doing little things and managing their routine and managing this and that before you actually have to introduce the idea of taking keys away or caregivers or how your hand or cash. It's taking risk. You know, how much risk am I willing to take? We talked about on the investment side. And then don't overstate what you're capable of doing. If you're having a meeting with your brothers and sisters, and unfortunately my son's an only child and he's always saying, I'm going to stick you in the nursing home. I'm like, fine, whatever you want to do is fine with me. My wife, on the other hand, is saying, nope. And that rang in her dad's ears. Never put me in the nursing home. So we did all we could do. We had a lot of faith. We stuck to it, and you know what? It worked out. So his services were this week, Wednesday night showing, Thursday morning funeral. He's a Korean veteran, former Monroe County highway worker, city worker, worked in the stone quarries, one of 10 kids, the oldest of 10 kids, grew up in Sanders, and still lived there, actually lived there his entire life. At 85 years old, he lived in the same spot besides the time he was in Korea for 85 years because his parents' house burnt down in front of them, and they actually built one behind them. So pretty incredible story, a great life. Wanted to make sure I told people that if you need help, please, please call me. Hey, I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll talk to you next week as we talk Department of Labor. Fun stuff, fiduciary standard, even funner. We'll be back next week. This is Your Money with David Hayes. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.